It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is now 3 weeks into the federal government shutdown, where Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill are locked in a stalemate over funding for health care.
Wisconsin's Labor Department is now warning that a number of job services could be interrupted because of suspended federal funding.
According to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, it gets three-quarters of its $500 million operating budget from the federal government.
Without those federal funds, job support services like unemployment insurance administration, state apprenticeship programs, and career counseling could be put on hold.
To discuss the situation, we're joined now by Amy Pahacik, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Pahacik, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So your department is operating at 25% of its normal operating budget. What can you tell us about the current budget situation?
Well, we have all of our services for our job centers and unemployment and our equal rights division and workers' compensation division still going strong. We have not cut any of those services at this time. However, there have been three immediate impacts really to the workforce in the state of Wisconsin as a result of this ongoing stalemate at the federal government. Perhaps the largest impact to the workforce here in Wisconsin is directly to the 8,000 furloughed workers that are federal employees that live in our state. Kate, you may be aware there's approximately 18,000 federal workers in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes.
About 10,000 of those workers are military or veterans affairs and so far have not been impacted by the shutdown. But there are 8,000 approximate furloughed employees who have not been receiving a paycheck for the last 3 weeks. We also have been unable to release our labor market monthly job reports, which is critical data that policy users, businesses, investors, governments use to make critical fiscal decisions. And we also have not been able to complete H-2A and H-2B visa certifications for the labor shortage. We are doing our part, but we send that piece to the U.S. Department of Labor, who is currently shut down and therefore not validating those labor shortage certificates that we issue at the Department of Workforce Development.
Okay, going back to immediate impact number one that you pointed out with the federal workers in Wisconsin, what are you seeing right now with initial unemployment claims?
So it's interesting because in prior shutdowns, most federal employees can rely on the fact that they will get back pay. And therefore, even though they are not receiving a paycheck, it's typically holding out and waiting for the shutdown to end, and then they would be made whole. We know that President Trump has been threatening to not issue back pay and in many cases to terminate the employment of the federal workers, including the 8,000 that are at play here in Wisconsin. So using unemployment historically during shutdowns has been more of a temporary loan because those folks would have to pay it back. However, we also know that more than 58% of people in this country live paycheck to paycheck. So not receiving a paycheck for 3 weeks is of significant hardship to most families in our country. And we have seen approximately 100 unemployment claims that have been filed by federal workers now. And as the weeks go on, we expect that number to rise.
I was noticing Michigan has stood up a website for its federal workers whose jobs are affected may be eligible to receive state unemployment benefits. Is this type of support happening here in Wisconsin?
Yes, we have a website and a FAQ. We also have a call center that can answer any questions for our federal workers who may have, you know, benefit questions or how to apply or what does this mean and what could be the potential ramifications if they do receive back pay. So we have all of that information on our website. Again, you can also call and talk to individuals. And we have been doing other supports for our federal workers, including when there were large scale reduction in forces. when President Trump was laying off significant portions of the federal workforce before the shutdown. We held career fairs and outreach and job fairs to help transition those individuals in Wisconsin who were impacted by those large-scale layoffs to other careers and make connections not only in state government but in the private sector as well.
Let's move on to your immediate impact number two. You mentioned the jobs report. There is a jobs data blackout right now. Bureau of Labor Statistics not publishing its monthly jobs report. Explain how the government shutdown affecting your department's ability to provide workforce data. Who uses that data? Who might be affected by this?
Yeah, so the jobs report, which is issued every month, each state collects certain data points and sends those data points to the Bureau of Labor Statistics at the U.S. Department of Labor. And those include things like wage information, new hires, employment data, and unemployment data. And those numbers come from the state, go to the federal government. They add additional components from the U.S. Census Bureau about household surveys and national employment and wage data, and then release the monthly jobs report. And that is really an indicator of the health of our economy. And that information is used broadly. It's used in the private sector by businesses to determine if they should open another job site or hire or perhaps lay off workers based on the trending of the national markets. It is also used by local and state and federal policy makers who set large-scale fiscal policies. For instance, should the Federal Reserve cut the interest rates, right? Are we seeing inflation? All of that feeds into the Consumer Price Index and those inflationary numbers. And it's really how we track how we are doing from an economic standpoint. And it is the data that both domestic and foreign investors rely on to invest in the United States economy and our market. And it's one of the things that has been a great stabilizer of our economy for decades, which is we have very transparent data, and data is what decision makers need to make investments in our economy. Without the data, we fear, our economists fear, domestic investments, foreign investments will start to wane, and that will cause further economic impacts, not only to our workforce, but just to the stability of our entire economy.
And I should note, though, that I think we have some inflation data coming out on Friday. Is that right?
That is correct. That will be, my understanding, is the last inflation data that will be coming out, because Social Security needs to do a statutory adjustment to their benefits based on that data. But after that, it is unclear when or if additional data will be available anytime soon.
Amy Pahacik is with us, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, as we talk about how job services in Wisconsin could be impacted by the federal government shutdown. Most of the department's funding comes from the federal government. Turning to your point number three with these H-2A visas, other industries where the labor force is particularly affected right now is these migrant workers who come in to fill jobs, thousands coming in from other countries to Wisconsin. What can you tell us about these agricultural visa holds?
Yeah, Kate, it's a great question. So Wisconsin's number one industry is agriculture. It is our largest industry. It's our sector. It is basically the backbone of our economy, with manufacturing following closely behind, but we are America's dairyland. And many of our agriculture activities are seasonal, meaning we have to bring in migrant seasonal workers to our state to do things such as the planting, the growing, the harvesting, and the processing of food, which again is very seasonal based on how things grow here in our state and our weather. And last year we had slightly over 3,000 migrant seasonal workers coming in to support those activities here in our state. And we had just under 2,000 H-2B workers, which are seasonal workers in other areas aside from agriculture. So that could be manufacturing, that could be medical-based, engineering, technology-based. And those workers are filling a gap that we do not have domestic workforce to fill. And right now, the Department of Workforce Development does a certification process where we would verify after recruiting and trying to fill those jobs with local Wisconsin workers, and our inability to do that would allow us to certify that there is a worker shortage and that we need that seasonal migrant labor help to complete these critically and time-sensitive functions for our industries here. So without that certification, we send that to USDOL, they validate it, and then the State Department would issue the visa. That component of the certification is what will not happen as the U.S. Department of Labor is currently shut down. So we see the greatest influx of H-2A applications in December and January in preparation for the spring planting, harvesting, and growing season. So we need the federal government to get together to get a resolution in place for funding, because as the shutdown continues, these long-term impacts are really going to be significantly harmful to the people of Wisconsin.
Secretary Pachek, you know, Wisconsin having a robust budget surplus to end the 2025 fiscal year, a rainy day fund is at a record high of nearly $2 billion. Can our state step in with some stopgap funds to continue, you know, these DWD programs and administrations so there aren't interruptions?
So I am not the only agency that relies on federal funds. In fact, many of the other state agencies rely heavily on federal funds as well. And there just simply is not enough money in the state to continue to fund all of the ongoing programs and services. You know, the National Labor Exchange and labor programs, which have been in place for nearly 100 years, have always been funded at the federal level. And that is because the federal government has recognized how important workforce is to the national economy and the health and prosperity of our country. And so Wisconsin sends significant funds to the federal government every year. And in turn, we get those funds back to operate a lot of these programs. There is just not enough money in the state budget to continue to fund everything and replace all of the funding that the federal government sends back to the state, to all of the states, to continue to move forward. So the answer here is not state stepping in and trying to fund this. It is not long term. It's not sustainable. We need Congress to get back and to figure this out.
Secretary Pachek, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Amy Pachek, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. We talked about how state job services in Wisconsin could be impacted by the federal government shutdown that is now into day 21.
Coming up, there's a tariff on foreign chocolate brought into the U.S., and chocolate was already facing short supply and high costs. Two Wisconsin chocolatiers tell us about the impact on their businesses and their customers.
We just have to pass that on to our customers, which we hate doing, but it's just the way things are going right now.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Housing across Wisconsin is getting more expensive. Manufactured home communities, often called mobile home parks, provide unsubsidized, affordable housing to thousands of residents.
But parks are raising prices around the country, a trend advocates tie to more private equity ownership.
One solution could be resident-owned cooperatives. But as Addie Costello reports, forming a co-op isn't always an easy decision.
Countryside Park Cooperative is a tight-knit community with 20 manufactured homes. After living in the Barron County community for well over a decade, Morris Buzowitz can't walk outside without getting into a conversation with a neighbor.
I have a feeling about that. I don't like to walk in the park because I'm walking for exercise, and there's too much conversation.
To actually get a workout, 83-year-old Buzowitz walks laps in the cemetery across the street. Buzowitz and his neighbors don't just chat about the weather. They run the park together. The community converted to a resident-owned co-op right before he and his wife started renting a lot.
It's worked out really good for 20 years.
Like many manufactured homeowners, they pay a monthly fee for the land their home sits on. But those fees don't go to a commercial owner. That's part of what drew them to the park.
It was a well-kept park, and that's part of being a co-op. People own part of the park, and they take care of it.
Members serve on the board, volunteer to mow the grass, and meet throughout the year to vote on big decisions.
It can be a solution for our housing crisis because it stabilizes existing manufactured housing locations, and it's a solution for addressing the loneliness epidemic.
That's Erica Young. She's the director for Housing Access and Affordability at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. It's a nonprofit research foundation focused on land use. She says that because co-ops like Buzowitz's don't pay out profits to members, residents' fees
are being plowed back into the community versus being extracted by an investor.
Buzowitz's monthly fee has stayed pretty much the same for 20 years when adjusted for inflation, but residents at new co-ops can see bigger jumps. Purchasing their communities often requires large loans, and once residents own their park, they're responsible for all the maintenance. Taking care of things like aging trees, roads, and sewage systems can be a lot of work, Young says.
They are a solution because not every community should become one.
Even when a co-op might be a good fit, owners have to be willing to sell to their residents. Some states like Minnesota offer financial incentives to owners who sell to co-ops. They also require owners to tell residents when they might sell. Wisconsin does neither. And residents have to be willing to run what is essentially a complex business. Vicki Breaker bought a manufactured home in Cedar Falls Acres 49 years ago and isn't sure she's ready to sign up for that. But the park's longtime owner is ready to sell. Breaker and other residents of the Dunn County Park won't have a say in who takes over.
Which we shouldn't, but yet it'd be nice if we could, you know, being that we're ones to live in here.
If she could pick the park's next buyer, she'd want to see another local owner. But individual owners are becoming more rare as the industry has seen more consolidation and interest from investment firms. This summer, a nonprofit watchdog group found 79 of Wisconsin's manufactured home parks are owned by private equity firms. Experts estimate the state has more than 900 communities. Breaker worries that a large corporate owner would increase her rent.
I'd love to say, yeah, I can do that, no problem. But it would be very, very difficult. Very difficult.
But she still has a lot of questions when other residents discuss buying the park as a co-op. She worries that would result in a rent increase too. Co-op organizers say the growing interest from investment companies has meant bigger purchase loans for co-ops. Since hearing about the sale, she's thought about selling her home and looking for an apartment. That would mean giving up her carefully decorated lawn.
I just can't make myself do it. I love being outside.
But she might not have a choice, depending on the new owner's rent. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. You might notice the price of chocolate on the rise this season because of supply disruptions and tariffs are increasing costs.
We're checking in with two Wisconsin chocolate makers to find out how the international market is affecting their business.
Dan Beezer is founder and head chocolate maker at Tabal Chocolate in Wauwatosa, and Dan Jokey, general manager of Sarugi's Chocolates in De Pere. Dan Jokey, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Dan Beezer, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for asking.
Before we get into chocolate supply concerns and tariffs, I want to get a taste of the business you both do with chocolate. Let's start with Tabal. Dan, talk about, please, your operation and your source for chocolate.
Yes, we were founded. I founded the company in 2012. We're a bean-to-bar chocolate-making company. We specialize in single-origin, direct-trade chocolate. I traveled down to origin in Peru, Colombia, Costa Rica, all over Central and South America to work directly with farmers. We're particularly challenged by the current commodities prices and those type of things. But we create a variety of products, including dark chocolate, a limited amount of milk chocolates, chocolate tea, chocolate spreads, cacao nibs, and drinking chocolate, as well as hot chocolate mixes. Everything made in-house from the cacao bean. I think that's what differentiates us.
And Sarugi's, Dan Jokey, tell us a little bit about your work there. Been at it for a while.
Yeah, I've been with working for the family for 46 years. We've been, for as long as I've been there, we've been sourcing our chocolate from the same suppliers Other than maybe whites and some dark and some blending, but our milk chocolate, unlike Dan, he does primarily dark chocolate. Our flagship is milk chocolate by and large, 10 times more than white or dark, or even sugar-free for that matter. But we've been sourcing from the same suppliers for all the years that I've worked there.
And Dan Jokey, staying with you for a moment, before we get to tariffs, I've been reading for some years now about concerns with chocolate supply. There's only a limited number of places that chocolate is coming from. What have you seen? How has this affected your prices?
Well, the prices, as everybody knows, is and almost everything else, too, is through the roof. Chocolate is seeing some numbers that have never been seen before. It hit a peak at close to $13,000 a metric ton. It is now fallen off. It's giving us a little bit of relief. We're down in just below $6,000 a metric ton, but still extremely high compared to what it's still twice as much as what we had been paying prior to all this.
And for Tabal, Dan Beezer, what you're working directly with these farmers around Central South America, I think the Caribbean too. How have the price fluctuations, again, I'm talking pre-tariff here, affected your supply?
Yeah, I think Dan just nailed it there. In 2023, it was somewhere around $3,000. In 2024, it went up to $13,000. And this year, $12,000. And now somewhere around 6,000, like Dan was suggesting. We purchase super premium cacao, so our beans are ranging in the $15,000 to $20,000 a metric ton, which is 2,200 pounds of beans. A lot of people follow the commodity rate, but we pay a premium over that and look for the super premium cacao that's available in the world.
Dan Jokey, what's going on? What's leading to those price increases for chocolate? Is it the world is eating more chocolate and it's demand side, or are there supply issues?
There is a greater demand, but there's a whole bunch of different things that factor into this. When you're reading about it, anywhere from sometimes there can be civil war going on, there can be poor farming applications. There can be a rootworm, you know, that can affect the cocoa plants. Drought in some areas, or sometimes even too much rain can be a problem. And then investors sometimes are manipulating the market some as well. And I don't quite understand that. It's inverted. Supposedly they're saying the market is inverted now. And it may not ever go back from what I'm being told anyway.
Okay, that's what we were dealing with coming into this year. Now along come tariffs. Cocoa, not an exception to the tariffs. I know the picture changes from time to time, but the tariffs are there. Dan Beezer, I assume when you go to your farmers and you're buying that premium chocolate, you are also paying tariffs on it now.
Yes, when we buy our cacao beans, it's interesting. It's a whole new line on our invoices. It says the tariffs, and usually there's one or two tariffs thrown in there. On the average for one pallet, we're paying an extra $500 for the Trump tariff tax. And, you know, we just have to pass that on to our customers, which we hate doing, but it's just the way things are going right now. I just wanted to add on to Dan's comments about what we notice, because 70% of all the cacao in the world is grown in Africa, they got hit super hard with drought and with flooding last year. And it wiped out a huge percentage of the world's cacao supply. And that drove the commodity rate way up through the roof. And then the rest of the world said, well, as long as it's up, we're going to raise our prices too. And so kind of worldwide, all the prices went up. We get most of our cacao from Central and South America and the Caribbean, but they did not get hit by all that. But everybody raised their prices to match the commodity rate.
And Dan Jokey, how have tariffs affected your bottom line, maybe the costs for consumers if you pass that on at Tsurugi's?
It has. And, you know, at the beginning of the year, there was a dip in the cocoa market. And so I contracted for the entire year at a fixed price. And it turned to be a favorable decision. But come May, I get a letter saying we're going to be adding 10% to all of your shipments for tariffs. And I'm going, what? I said, I already contracted for all of this for this entire year. And they said, well, that's just the way it is. And we're not going to eat this cost, like Dan said. And, you know, we have to pass it on to you. And in turn, you know, it forced us to raise our prices. We try to do it as little as possible, but you wonder where the breaking point is going to be. But it's a huge, huge expense. And they're hoping that maybe it's going to go away because cocoa beans can't be made in America. But nothing's changed yet.
We're talking about how Wisconsin chocolate is affected by cocoa tariffs and international market disruptions. Our guests are Dan Beezer from Tabal Chocolate in Wauwatosa, Dan Jokey from Tsurugi's Chocolate in De Pere. Dan Jokey, I want to follow up on what you just mentioned there. A lot of the argument for tariffs is, yes, there might be some price pain for a bit, but that's going to stimulate domestic producers in whatever category we're tariffing here to build up production. If I wanted to start a chocolate company and have American-supplied cocoa beans, I'm in a science fiction novel. Is there any way to do that?
Well, no. If I'm correct, you have to be, Dan, do you have to be 20 degrees north or south of the equator?
Yeah. Usually, there's two exceptions, Hawaii and Puerto Rico. And both of them, Hawaii in particular, is extremely expensive to get shipped here. Puerto Rico is a little bit better. Like you said, Dan, it's 20 degrees north and 20 degrees south of the equator all around the world. 70% approximately is all grown in Africa. So it's difficult to get.
I guess unless you can do it in a Petri dish, maybe.
Lab-grown chocolate. Now, I wanted to ask about demand. I mean, Halloween is a demand time for chocolate, but I guess I could think of Valentine's Day and Easter and Christmas. Are there a lot of peaks and valleys where customers are really going to notice these variation in prices? And Dan Beezer, let's start with you.
I'm guessing I don't buy chocolate, but what I'm hearing on the street is that all the commodity chocolate, the big chocolate companies are raising their Halloween candy prices just because of the cost of their ingredients. And I would anticipate prices are going to go up across the board. Just to take a step back for a second, we're super committed to supporting our small scale farmers. Most of our farmers work on farms that are 5 acres or less. We're engaged with direct trade with them. And on the average, we pay, even when our price of cacao is low, we pay $500 over the commodity rate to our farmers just to support the small holder producers, is what we call them, and to help their prosperity so they can plant more trees, so they can develop their facilities and develop their cacao farms. So yes, the price went up, but in a strange way, in a good way, it kind of matches with our goal to get more money to those small scale farmers. And like Dan alluded to before, we worry about money getting siphoned off by the middlemen, and that's why we try and work as directly as possible with farmers.
Dan Jokey, also on the demand side, do you see at Tsurugi's, you've had to bump up prices some because of the cocoa supply, because of the tariffs. Is that leading people, you think, to buy less of your chocolate? They're saying, I love the stuff, but it's out of my price point now.
I don't think we've seen that yet. Not that it can't come, and it depends on what happens with the cocoa prices going forward. But our customer base has been pretty consistent yet. You know, our sales in our stores are are doing okay. We're not seeing, I don't think we even get a lot of verbiage from customers, you know, saying, oh, your prices are too high, or, you know, everybody understands that everything is high, not just chocolate. And it's just finding it to be the way of the world right now. So it could happen, but you wonder what the breaking point is. We have not seen that yet.
I wanted also just to ask another concern of a lot of businesses in Wisconsin is labor supply. But some people are doing fine, and I just wanted to get a pulse check on that from both of you. At Sarugi's, are you having any trouble finding the workers you need?
We are. I think we have a 40% turnover rate. You know, and I used to have applicants come in the door, and I had more than I could look at. And now I hardly get in at all, and we have to be searching and reaching out, and we're working with several different staffing agencies just to try to get enough help to come in the building to keep us going for the holiday season.
And Dan, I know Tabal is a smaller operation. Do you have the hands you need there?
At the moment, we have an awesome staff. We have about a dozen people that work in the shop there, producing and manning the retail side, and we've got a remarkably professional and hardworking staff that's been pretty stable. When we lose someone, it's usually they're going off to college. They've kind of timed out, so to speak, and that's when we typically lose people. But I think, quality product and great reputation, like both of our chocolate companies, really help stabilize things as much as possible. And we've been very fortunate to have a wonderful, stable staff.
And just asking for a friend, either of you need a taster?
I always like tasters.
I have a little list behind my desk of people volunteering to be on the tasting team. I do need to have an event like that. That would be awesome.
We'll leave it there. Dan Beezer, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Dan Jokey, thanks for being with us.
Hey, you're so welcome.
Dan Jokey with Sarugi's Chocolate and De Pere, Dan Beezer, Tabal Chocolate in Wauwatosa.
Coming up, a new memoir shares a story of a Milwaukee native who left the state and found a new love for his hometown during the Bucks NBA championship run.
The Bucks or sports became this highway that I could just go and traverse in an instant between myself and my family and Milwaukee and my own identity in some ways.
The author of In the Room at the Top of the World, that's next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. A new memoir from a Wisconsin writer tells parallel stories of heartbreak and fandom, bouncing between life lessons and the historic 2021 NBA title run from the Milwaukee Bucks.
The memoir weaves the anecdotes of Wisconsin native Ben McCormick as he moves across the country. He finds new love for his hometown team as it keeps him connected with friends, family, and Milwaukee.
Ben McCormick joins us now. His new book is called In the Room at the Top of the World, Leaving the Midwest, the Bucks Title Run, and Other Survivals. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Of course. I'm happy to be here.
Your new book, it's a series of essays that follow along with the Milwaukee Bucks playoff run to their NBA title championship. What is it about the Bucks that drew you in and had this incredible personal connection for you during that run?
A lot of it for me started with moving away from Milwaukee. Like anybody else in Milwaukee, I always was attached to the Brewers in one season, the Packers in the fall, and the Bucks, and anything kind of around. But it was when I left the city that I really started to pull on some like different parts of my identity as a Milwaukeean or a Wisconsinite. And the Bucks were one of those. And it was such a lively period. I remember attending games when they were awful in the Bradley Center, and I loved it. And so to kind of have this boom period with them and with Giannis as a part of the team and the organization, it was just something that was really easy for me to stay attached and to stay in touch with my family and text about games and my friends as well. And it's only ever grown from there.
your connection with Milwaukee. Now, you left, and you talk in the book about people who have left Milwaukee over the years to do great things, Oprahs and Gene Wilders and Liberace's, things like that. There seems to be this ambiguity, this feeling like if I want to do great things, I have to leave Wisconsin, I have to leave Milwaukee. What does that make you think about your connection to your place of origin?
It makes me feel a lot of pride now. What I know now that I didn't know then, and is chronicled in the book, is that feeling that you want to get out and go do something great. And I think that there's a duality that people who are from the Midwest feel about this like urgency of things that are happening in New York or in Los Angeles, and that I want to be a part of that. But then you also feel this intense pride for, but what's happening here is really important and is something that is as vital as something else. And so for me, I was, high on my own supply in my own way, where I thought I was going to get out there and I was going to write the big book and get the big deal. And when you think that life is going to go A to B, it has a way of taking you to C or to D or to E or to F. And for me, I didn't really realize how much of my identity was tied up in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee until I left and I got to experience other areas, and I realized just how Wisconsin I was.
Set the scene for us in your own life. You're watching this from afar in Portland, mm-hmm. at this point, and going through some big and not always for the better changes in your own life. Where were you as you were watching the Bucks from afar?
I was on a futon in the second bedroom of an apartment I was sharing with somebody I had moved to Oregon with, and I had the door closed. We had only a futon in there and a TV. It was maybe like a 40-inch television. And really, it was all those things with me, and I would watch all the games, and I had my phone just on my lap. And I would have a group chat of friends that we had been texting throughout every single one of the games, and then my family as well. It was something where I moved here to Portland, and I had this life that was topsy-turvy, but I could close that door and kind of transport myself or connect myself back to being in Milwaukee in a different way. And it was something that became an area of peace for me and something that felt like home in a way that when I left Milwaukee, in my early 20s, that it just hadn't in its own way, and that it was something that I really needed at that time. And so I spent, those whole 5-6 weeks, on that futon and texting people and just staying in touch and tending to those bonds with a place that I had kind of written off in a way that I think was a mistake in hindsight. I'm really happy I reconnected.
Let's focus in on the Bucks side of thing a little bit here. People may be hearing this and thinking, oh, this guy, fair weather fan, he jumps into this championship run, he's a writer looking for something to write about. As I read you writing about basketball, that is not the case. You are really invested in watching the Bucks play.
I am, and I really appreciate you. I really appreciate you letting me Trojan horse sports into your programming on public radio. But one thing that I realized during that run, and for every season that I've watched them over the course of my life, is that I feel real emotion like about those games. And I think fans do. You get really bummed out if your team has a heartbreaking loss. You get like truly elated, and it affects you when you win and find a level of any kind of a win or a success. And so for me, I wanted to write toward, and I wanted to explore these are real emotions that I'm feeling. And like, what if I treated my own emotions with the level of seriousness that, we treat other kinds of things that elicit our emotions? And what would happen if I did that? And what I realized was that, the Bucks or sports became this conduit. It became this highway that I could just go and traverse in an instant between myself and my family and Milwaukee and my own identity in some ways. And so, yes, I am a guy who has seen every minute of preseason basketball this season. I watch every single game, and it's something that is always transporting me back to who I think I used to be. And also it keeps me in touch with the person I am here today. And when thinking about whether or not I'm still a Milwaukeean or a Wisconsinite, and it makes me feel like the answer is always yes.
We say, I think, kind of vague things when a team has a great run, how it brings the community together, right? People really came together to support the team. You were really living that, right? You were thousands of miles away, but as you've mentioned already, you felt this build your ties with your family and your hometown. Talk a little bit about how that worked for you.
When you grow up in a Wisconsin family, and this is like something of a cultural norm, I think I wasn't necessarily coached to talk about my emotions or my feelings or to share those things very openly, especially like growing up as a male. And, you know, sports kind of became this filter through which, especially in that run, that you could really strengthen truly real human ties with people through something that was beyond just simple words or it was beyond language or numbers or like social media. We all held this part of our identity and we could hold it all together. And it became easy for us to find things that we have in common and to have pride and be really proud and joyous all together in a community space. And I really, that run shaped so much of how I view the world now in terms of the importance of sharing in emotions and joy in community with other people. And the like Deer District is the image that everybody remembers from that run, like the 8,000 and 10,000 people or 20,000 in the finals. And that kind of unity and that kind of joy is something that watching from my couch in Portland, Oregon, staying in touch with all of my family members. And then ultimately in the book, I do make it back into Wisconsin mm-hmm. over the course of the finals. It is something that was very emotional for me to see this amazingness that is Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and this place that I wound up taking so much pride in, that it was every bit as great, and it proved it on the national scale as any one of the gigantic mega cities in the United States. What was happening there was vital, and it was joyous, and it was amazing.
Ben McCormick is with us. We're talking about his new book, In the Room at the Top of the World, Leaving the Midwest, the Bucks title run, and other survivals. Ben, talking about men and emotion, just before I sat down to talk to you here, I rewatched Giannis Antetokounmpo after the closing seconds of the final game, sitting, crying, tears of joy, just spent emotion so much. That image, I think, is something that stuck with a lot of people, that expression of emotion after this amazing journey.
What Giannis has said is, and he, I have goosebumps right now, even just, you know, having the thought of it, is he sat down and he thought about his father who had passed away, who was here in Milwaukee with him when he made the big movie and was brought over with the whole rest of his family. And that moment encapsulates for me that, you know, sports are a spectacle. They are a game, but they do resonate with us on deeply personal levels. And being able to share in that moment with somebody who is a champion and who is as personally excellent as Giannis is, the kind of empathy that everybody could feel in that moment and then share in it themselves and find a connection between us and this guy who is so much better at this thing than I will ever be, really helped accentuate and emphasize for me just how sports are so real. And I think that it's a good thing sometimes to, in their own way, start to really treat them that way. And I think it's incumbent on like men and males who are kind of raised in ways to be like stoic, the stiff upper lip, to like take our emotions seriously, however they express themselves. And I think that that is a positive step that anybody takes. And sports is just the avenue that it was for me.
The thing that Giannis is supposed to do by the NBA script is move to a major market, right? Build a super team around him in, I don't know, Los Angeles, Miami, whatever. He's talked lately, hey, maybe I want to finish my career in Greece when I'm too old for the NBA. How important is it that he, after all the will he or won't he, that he has stayed in Milwaukee so far?
It's something that doesn't happen anymore in sports because they've written that script for him or for many different athletes being a one franchise player. And it's something that you can feel in Milwaukee when people bring it up. It drives anxiety in people to think about him moving elsewhere and that people feel that, listen, what is in Milwaukee is awesome. And Giannis has said over and over again that he is here and he is committed. He wants to be a part of this team. We're entering year six of the national media speculating about whether or not Giannis wants to leave. And it feels like longer. But to hear him as well kind of talk about Greece in that loving way is something that I don't think that bothers fans in Milwaukee as much as the talk about, oh, he's going to go to the Knicks or he's going to go to Los Angeles. I think that people understand that connection that he has to us in Milwaukee and his real family at home. And that's something that can be manufactured for him to be on a super team and then like try to win one more. I think that we all respect him as a competitor, but we respect and empathize and embrace him even more as a human being. And I've been this person who has thought about whether or not I'd move back home and whether or not I'd be happy there. And I really think I would, that it's just one other way that in the unlikeliest way or scenario that I could be anything like Giannis.
You mentioned the idea of home, and your last essay in the book is written in the form of a letter to your niece. And in it, you're talking about home. I'm going to read a little bit. Home is not a place that will always be the same and is never a single person. The way we tend to think about home is more of an area at a specific point in time when it's really a living organism. Expand on that idea of home as not a fixed thing, but a thing that changes with our relationship to it.
When you move away from home, I'm the only member of my family who lives outside of 10 minutes of each other, maybe 15 on the wrong day on traffic on 94. And the way that things change when I am not there every single day, and so I kind of leave the city and I'll come back 3 months later, things will be so different. And what I've also realized that over the course of the time, I change as well. So there's a wrestling that anybody who leaves home has to do with is, you know, when I go back home, am I in better touch with the place that I left and the memory that I had? Or am I able to love this place on its own terms for who and what it is? And for the explosion of emotions that I felt over the course of that time and that I felt since living here in Oregon away from home, I think I've gotten a lot better at loving the city on its own terms as it is and the way that it evolves. And that's through its people. The people age, the people change, and I think I can love them in their own way.
Ben, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
That's Ben McCormick, a writer born in Wisconsin, lifelong Bucks fan. He's the author of the new book we've been talking about. It's called In the Room at the Top of the World, Leaving the Midwest, the Bucks Title Run, and Other Survivals. Do you have a personal connection with a big sports story like Ben did, where the success of that team or lack of same was a big part of your life at the time? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Later this week, we'll hear from the author of a new book about the Berkey, the American Birkebeiner cross-country ski marathon in Hayward.
And we want to hear your Berkey stories and share them on the show. Have you raced in one or more of the annual events? How did it go?
Do you go back year after year?
And if you live in the Hayward area, are you one of the 2,000 plus volunteers who help make the event happen?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.